What's good? Welcome to the What's Good podcast. I'm your host, Milton Young. Welcome to episode 16, another solo podcast. Today we're going to be talking about confidence. Get right into it. I got asked a question about confidence. Why am I so confident? Why am I so confident on stage? And that's a simple answer. Because I was meeting with a friend and we were talking about, you know, different styles and comedy and how different comedians connect with the audience and how different comedians resonate with the audience, the confidence that they have. Some of them aren't confident, and that's funny. And where did I get mine being the fact that I haven't been doing comedy for so long? And I get my confidence from because I have been doing comedy for so long. I think when you're confident in something is because you have the experience in it. And I think with comedy, I've been doing comedy and trying to get attention and being in front of a class. And since I was in elementary school, so I know that I'm funny. And with the preparation and the classes and working with someone like Bill Keller, that's worked with people that are funny, and then he's telling you that you're funny, all of those type of things, then you're putting the work in, you're taking the time to write the jokes, you're taking the time to go to the open mics, you're taking the time to get the feedback from the audience that your material is strong. After a while, you begin to get more confident in yourself. So I've come off as confident because I am confident. The only reason I'm confident is because I put the work in. I think anybody that is good at what they do and is confident in what they do, I think is mainly because they've been there so many times. They have the experience and they have the benefit of failure, right? I've heard, because I haven't bombed yet and I know it's going to happen. I don't want it to happen. But every comic bombs. And what's bombing? Bombing is when you go up on stage, you have an act, and it sucks. It could be one of your best acts. It could be one of your best bits. It could be one of your whatever. If you don't have the right audience, you don't have the right energy, you're not prepared, so to speak, mentally, and you go up and you just bomb. You just don't connect with that audience on that particular night. And there's nothing you can do about it except for eat it. And what I've heard is through those type of failures, you end up having some of your best performances. Because through that type of torture and that type of pain, you kind of go back and reanalyze everything that you've done in preparation for that act or on that material. And you really just reflect and dig on what worked, what didn't work, and what you need to improve on. And the only way to do that is, well, it's a lot of different ways. What I was taught by Bill Keller, and I think that's why I come off as confident as I am, is because I know what hard work is, and I know when I put in that hard work, I come off as funny. And it's writing every day. It's making sure that when you do make an observation, you write it down. Get it on paper. That's one thing Bill used to say all the time in class, was get it on paper. And the reason why he would say it all the time was because it's probably the hardest part of being a comic. It's probably one of the hardest parts of doing anything, is getting it on paper. You know, I don't know if people realize this, but when you go and you look at some of the scripts that are written, some of the most amazing scripts that are written, some of them were started on paper. Like literally on bar paper. They call that a comic book, a comics notebook, is literally the white napkins that you get from a bar. You get that and you write the jokes down on that. And that's getting it down on paper. That's the hardest part, because then you just forget it. Some of your best stuff you'll forget if you don't write it down. So that's another part, is making sure that you get it on paper. And the last, and I think the most important part of preparation and being prepared and working on your confidence, is getting to open mics and getting that pressure of having real people listen to you perform what you believe is funny. And when you go there, it's important to get on stage as a new comic, as an old comic, as whatever, any part of your your career, you really just need to be getting stage time whenever you can get up in front of people and tell your jokes and craft your jokes so they're better and they connect with the audience and that they're funnier and that you're more comfortable telling them. Some of the jokes that I wrote for the last show, I really had to practice them over and 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 over again. I'm not exaggerating that. Because every time you tell the joke, you find a different crevice. It gets more comfortable. It's a weird comparison, but it's just like a baseball glove. You know, the more you use it, the more comfortable you get in it, the more flexible it is. Same thing with the joke. When you know a joke inside out and you've told it over and over again, you get really comfortable with the nuances of the joke, the iteration, the tone, the pausing. There's a rhythmic tone to jokes as well. You get used to that. And you can kind of connect with the audience a little bit more because you know where they are in the joke. Sometimes when you write a joke, you feel that you're going to get, you know, because every joke has a beginning, middle, end. Sometimes if the beginning isn't funny, you'll get a laugh there. If the middle is funny, you'll get a little laugh there. And at the end, that's where you want your biggest laugh to be, right? You don't want your biggest laugh to be at the beginning of the joke. You want it to be at your punchline. So from getting from the beginning to the end, there's a lot of different things that you can do with your voice, with timing and pausing. And the more you tell the joke, the more you can find those nuances and those fine tuning of a joke. You know, if you look at the comedic timing of, say, a Chris Rock versus a Martin Lawrence versus, let's say, someone that's really different, like an Arsenio Hall versus an Eddie Murphy versus a Bill Cosby. All of them, their timing, their rhythm, their confidence on the stage, it's all different, right? They connect differently with the audience, you know? Eddie Murphy has more of his swagger on stage is just like something you've never seen. The outfits that he wears, the leather is just loud and obnoxious. And it kind of goes with his style. It's loud, obnoxious, but smooth and sharp and crisp. That's how his jokes are. You look at someone like Chris Rock, you're not looking at his outfit. You're looking at him. Your focus is on his facial expressions, where he is on the stage, his timing. It's just completely different. And then you look at someone like a Bill Cosby who's sitting, you know, he's stationary on the stage and not moving around, not generating any energy in that aspect, but just having him, you're focused on him, his voice, his calm demeanor, and you're just in his world listening to his story and just completely all very talented, all very confident. But you can see how all of those different comedians, how they connect with the audience differently. And they did that by just getting on stage, going to open mics and doing it nonstop over and over and over and over again. And that's how you get good at comedy. There's some young guys that are coming up on the scene that I have a pleasure of seeing at Comedy Works when we do open mics. And just from when they first started, you know, 2 or 3 months ago to now, just because of their repetition, their consistency, their dedication, you just see them getting better. And they're getting better because they're getting more confident. And when they're getting more confident in their material, they're getting more confident in their observations. And their observations are them, what they see and what they perceive the world to be. And when they start to put that on stage, it's a beautiful thing. It's amazing to be a part of. And there's just a lot of talent down that's coming up in Comedy Works. And it's because it's an awesome open mic. You know, we have an awesome host, Nick, who kills it. He does a very good job of creating an environment where new comics that are coming on aren't intimidated. When a new person's there, they always do an excellent job of greeting them, bringing them on the stage. They do a really good job of showing love. So, you know, if you're in this area, the Capital District, and you can get to Saratoga on Thursday nights and do the open mic, sign-ups around 7 and the mics start around 9, it's worth it because it's one of the best open mics in the area. And I say that confidently. And that's the other thing. You know, when I was playing poker, I played poker a lot when poker was just starting before the moneymaker era. And the moneymaker is the era when everybody was just playing poker because it was a thing to do, right? They were getting into these big tournaments for $5,000 and walking away with, you know, $10 to $15 million. Chris Moneymaker was a, who was he? He was a tax guy, and he just used to play poker at pickup games, and he'd go to the casino every once in a while. And one year he came in and he beat out all of these top pros and took it down. And then it just went boom. Everybody was playing poker. Well, that's when it was on ESPN and Turning Stone. You go to Turning Stone, you couldn't get a seat to sit down because it was just a big buzz. So I was playing before all that hit. I went to RPI. So there were a lot of kids there that were big on numbers and percentages, and they would play. And I got sucked in, and I got pretty good. When I say good, I mean one tournament I won $5,000, which was it was an awesome run. There were 1,100 people in it. The tournament went for like 16 hours, and I ended up taking home first place. It was an amazing run. When you play at that level, though, and this is the thing, there's some amazing players out there. You call them professionals because they make a living doing it. So they make a living playing cards. Those professionals get the same percentage of bad hands dealt throughout the whole entire game. They don't have an advantage because they're a professional. The cards don't favor them. The dealers don't favor them. You know, fate doesn't favor them. Luck doesn't favor them. They just play situations better than the average person does. And how does this relate to comedy? It relates to comedy because everything that I just named off, the writing every day, getting to the open mics, the observations, getting it to paper, there's always excuses not to do them. You know, there's always, you know, I got called into work, the dog is sick, the cat threw up, the fish drowned. There's always excuses for everything that you're trying to do in life. And the people that excel in those fields, that are just doing things that are such a high level, they're the ones that don't let the excuses get in the way. They just go over them like they're hurdles. They're obstacles, and they treat them like hurdles. They just go right over them, you know. And I say that with cards because, you know, Michael Jordan, Kobe, Allen Iverson. I don't know why I'm naming off basketball people right now, but that's just what I'm on. But all of those guys, they had the same difficulties as anybody else that was trying to become a professional basketball player. But they dealt with them differently. They went over them. They didn't let them get in the way. And it's the same thing when I was preparing for that show for that 6 weeks where I knew I had to write every single week. I didn't let anything get in my way. And there were things that were going wrong, just like in anybody's life, there's things that are going wrong. And some people let those things get in the way and stop them from moving forward, and other people use them as ways. They just treat them like obstacles, and they just get, you know, they go over it because they know that their real focus is this. And once your mind is on, you know, being focused, once you have a focal point for your mind, then everything else around it is just kind of, it's in the way, you know? So it doesn't matter what happens. You get called into work, you got to stay late, you got to work extra hours, car broke down, you had some event that you didn't expect to have to go to, you end up having to go to, some friend that you didn't expect was going to need your help, you need your help. But you know what? At the end of the day, you still got to get that time in to write. If it means that, you know, while you're waiting for something or while you're in the middle of something else that you're writing, then so be it. But that writing has to happen. That your mind has to get trained to think like that, and it has to get trained to execute like that. Because what I've noticed, and this is, I'm saying this to people that are thinking about not just doing comedy, but there's anything that you want to be good at, anything that you want to excel at, you just can't let excuses get in the way. And I've run into, in this journey of going towards comedy, some super talented people that excuses, and I'm not saying that they're excuses to them, but they're excuses. They don't register to them as excuses. And maybe it's because I'm training myself to see them as excuses, but that's what they are. They're excuses to do what you should be doing. Because, you know, if you have 10 things planned in a day and 11th thing gets thrown at you, then that means you have 11 things to do that day. But one thing on that list should always be focus on your craft. And when you have the discipline and when you have that type of mindset, it shows in your performance and it shows in your confidence. Because you know how prepared you are. And you know if something goes wrong, you're prepared for that. And you know something won't go wrong because you're too prepared for that. And that's just how it works. And if you don't feel prepared, it's because you didn't prepare enough. And it's simple stuff. It's just sometimes we, just like anything, we make it more complicated than it really is, you know? So if you're thinking about, if you're serious about, comedy, or you're serious about anything that you're serious about doing, photography, modeling, even jiu-jitsu, taking jiu-jitsu to another level. It's a matter of showing up and just getting it done. And don't let any excuse get in your way preventing it. I mean, everyone knows I train at Matt Secor, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu in Southlands Falls. And the guys there, some of my teammates, their willpower is unbelievable. Doesn't matter what's going on, snowstorm, blizzard, tornado, it doesn't matter. They're still going to show up and be on those mats, and they're going to be rolling, and they're going to be getting better because they want to be the best. And I was trying to explain to someone the other day that, when you have something like jiu-jitsu in your life and you're training with savages, people that are 100% dedicated to getting better, that don't like to get beat, that push themselves as hard as they push their team members, their training mates, and show up, it forces you to get better. Because if you don't get better, you're gonna fall behind in the pack. And after a while, the pack just starts to leave you. It's not intentional. It's all to get you better. And there's something about being exposed to that on a consistent level that just it bleeds into everything that you do in your life. So that's a big part of why I am a martial artist, because of the mental aspect of it, the mental advantage that it gives you. Some of these guys that I train with, even if they were to stop training for 5 years, they never stepped on a mat, right? Just their mental fortitude, just their willpower, and they don't give up. There's no give in these guys and these ladies. They're savages. We say it joking around, but it's not funny. These guys are savages. And if anybody was just to lock up with some of these people in the street just accidentally, and it wouldn't be accidental, it'd be that you had to push them to, yeah, you'd really have to just push them to a certain level where, you cross the line. And I would hate to see, even if they hadn't been training for 5 years, just their mental, if they weren't training jiu-jitsu, there's something they're working on. If they're not training jiu-jitsu, they're working on their wrestling, they're working on their hands, they're working on their endurance, their gas tank. And for people that know what gas tank is, it's a reference that a lot of people use in UFC or martial arts or MMA. And it's really how much endurance you have, the stamina that you have to keep going. And a lot of people have a bigger gas tank than other people, meaning that they can just go longer, faster, harder. And when you're going up against someone that has a bigger gas tank than you, they can just simply wear you out. I think perfect example of that is Max Holloway. Right now, he is the featherweight champ, 145 pound. Man, this guy is a machine. Max Holloway's output is unbelievable. It's like unlike anything the UFC has ever seen. His last fight, he put out some insane amount of number. When he went to Ortega, was a phenomenal fight. But I think there were 3 rounds to the fight. The last round, he put out like 210 punches. That's insanity. 210 punches that connected. And every punch you swing isn't connecting. So his output for that round, and it's the third round, like the first round or the second round, it's the third round. He should be getting tired, more tired, but he's just opening up. He's getting more fluid. He's getting more liquid. It's amazing to see. So when you hear people talk about gas tanks, that's what they're talking about. And the guys over at Matt Secor's, when it comes to jiu-jitsu, when it comes to just work, they put the time in. And it's great to be a part of that because, like I said, when you have team members that are holding you in that high level of accountability, man, you show up when you show up. You know that you ate the right lunch, you got a decent amount of sleep. You know you're going in there to work. You're not just going to go in there and roll around on the mat. You're going to get worked, and you're going to work people. So when you have that type of push in your life, it's different. It's different than going to the gym and moving weight. And I need that. Working out in the gym is a form of a meditation. Rolling in jiu-jitsu is also another form of meditation, but they're just completely different. One could get you can get choked out in one. I guess if you're doing squats, you could possibly get choked out if you don't do them right, but it's just a little bit more dangerous and requires different levels of focus and concentration because the consequences are a little different. We were talking about jiu-jitsu the other day and it being a superpower, and someone was asking me to explain what do I mean by jiu-jitsu being a superpower. Kids, I've actually heard kids refer to it as a superpower, jiu-jitsu. And I call it a superpower, and they refer to it as a superpower because that's exactly what it is. When you know jiu-jitsu, you have such an advantage over an average person that it is like a superpower because they don't know what's happening to them. And you can use it at any time. And because you have it in your back pocket and you know how powerful it is, it makes you confident. You look at superheroes, they're confident when they get put in certain situations because they know they have this ability that no one knows about, right? And same thing with jiu-jitsu. You know, when you can walk into a place and know that you can defend yourself, you can protect somebody, you can protect yourself, you can defend yourself, you can defend others. You've been put into an environment where you've tested these skills, you know that they're effective, and you know that you are efficient in using them. Then you just walk with a different, you walk with a different air to you. And it's not an arrogance thing, it's a confidence thing, and you exude it. And people if you're in tune with what's going on, people pick up on it. And like I said, it's nothing to do with arrogance. It's just a level of confidence, you know? And when you have that superpower with some of these kids too, when they walk around and these bullies come around, and they can exude that type of confidence, it's amazing. It's amazing. And if you're a woman and you're 122 pounds and you can choke out a man that's 240 pounds, you're going to feel like that's a superpower because it kind of is. What else would enable you to do something like that? You know, there's a lot of other martial arts disciplines. I don't know how many of them involving choking, but I know that jiu-jitsu is one of them. And if you can do that, if you're that 133-pound woman, that you're going to be walking around feeling that you do have a superpower in your hand. And if someone just walking by sees someone, 133-pound woman, strapped on the back of some guy with her hook set in and she's rear naked choking him, they're going to think she's got a superpower too. So, I think it's a superpower. And I think the confidence that it gives you makes you kind of feel that way. It's amazing how many people don't know how to defend themselves. And I bring it up a lot because, like I said, I thought I knew how to defend myself until I started doing jiu-jitsu and I realized I had no idea what I was doing. But it's amazing the people that don't know what they're doing and still want to start fights. And it's amazing the amount of people that don't know what they're doing. They don't know how to defend themselves but want to, and they don't have an outlet for that. The world is changing. It's getting a lot more dangerous. You have a lot more just strange people running around doing strange things. So I think more so now than ever, especially with the dating era that's going on around here, that self-defense, because more women's self-defense, children's self-defense, self-defense against bullying, believe it or not, those are all different things. They all need to be handled differently. And there's outlets for that. At Matt Secor's, we train for self-defense. Eddie Fivey, they train for self-defense. All the schools that train jiu-jitsu, they focus on these different aspects of women's self-defense. A woman's self-defense is going to be different than a child's self-defense because of the situations they're going to be getting themselves into. With jiu-jitsu, we try to teach kids that there's a verbal jiu-jitsu that you can use, that, you know, you try to talk to somebody before it turns into a physical alteration. It's the same thing with a female, how you would talk, what you would say to the person, the distance that you're going to maintain, how you would control that. Same thing with a kid. Those principles are the same, but getting in and out of those situations are a little more different. And the signs that you're looking for are a little more different. And the positions that you're going to be fighting out of are going to be a little bit more different. How a fight could start, how an altercation could start. There's going to be the same scenarios, but there's just different things that you're going to want to focus on. And then when you get older and you're just learning, you know, self-defense versus actual, you know, MMA application of a martial arts are total different things. The principles are the same for the moves, but how you get into them, how you get into out of them are completely different things. For example, if you're an MMA fighter and you're trying to learn jiu-jitsu, you're going to want to focus on the stand-up aspect of it, takedown defense, and taking someone down. It's going to be a lot more important to you, because with someone that's just practicing jiu-jitsu for the art of practicing jiu-jitsu to stay in shape and be fit, then most of the stuff that they're going to need to do is going to be on the ground anyway, with no real need for emphasis on them standing up. So it's just, it's a different world and a different application. And we do it all at C-Corps, but it's just, I want more people to know how to defend themselves, because I know how important it is to me now that I know how to do that. And I know when I go into a room, I look for different things and I pick up on different things because I know how to defend myself, and I can pick up on certain warning signs before they even become anything that I need to be worried about, just because I'm looking for different things. You walk in with different eyes when you know self-defense. Just like, you know, say a fire marshal, when he walks into a room, he's looking for different things. You know, someone that's in the military, when they walk into a room, they're looking for a different thing. Even cops, when they walk into a room, they're looking for different things. So a martial artist, when they walk in, they look for different things. And it's a strange thing to really try to explain to someone until you're in that spot. And, you know, you're looking for trouble, even though it's not there, you're prepared for it. You're not trying to set anything up, but if it goes down, you're ready. And that's just what a martial artist does. And that's how you kind of live your life, that readiness at all times. And that's why you train, because you just want to turn everything into reflexes. You know, I like to do a lot of different things. Comedy, the podcast, martial arts, writing, working out. All of them have the same mechanism, in the sense that when you start getting repetition, it becomes more intuitive and it becomes more instinctive. You know, when you get up on stage and you're going through your act and you've done it 3 times that week, you've been to 4 different open mics and you've gone through your act 3 different times, 3 different ways, that repetition, when you get on stage, it shows in your jokes, it shows in your confidence. Same thing with, you know, when you're working out and you start going into the gym and you've been going there consistently and your weight is consistently going up, you're doing the movements, you know, and you're focusing on your breathing, you're focusing on your reps, it just becomes easier. The workouts take, you know, an hour, something that used to take you an hour and 15 minutes to do, you're doing in 45 minutes, just smoother, just down. Same thing with jiu-jitsu. The more I go, the more I'm on the mat, the easier the technique comes to me, the easier it is for me to execute. And it's just amazing. It's an amazing process to go through, just to watch your body, the way it changes and starts reacting the way that it should. You know, when jiu-jitsu, I keep on going back and doing a couple days here, a couple days there. I haven't been going back consistently as I'd like. But when I do go back, I realize that, you know, how sluggish my technique is, because I'm not there working on it every single day, putting in the mat time, putting in the time to, you know, work on my technique, to expand on my technique, to focus on a certain area, focus on a certain side. When I don't do those things, I feel it. Same thing with stage. You know, they call it ring rust. Some people call it mat rust. Some people call it stage rust. And we're all talking about different things. I mean, for comedy, they call it stage rust if you don't go on the stage for a long time. You know, if you don't fight in the ring for a long time, they call it ring rust. And if you haven't been on the mat rolling jiu-jitsu, they call it, it's just rust. And the reason why they call it rust, because you're slow, your movement is kind of slowed down, your thinking is slowed down, because you're not there putting in that time and working on those reflexes and making it, you know, second nature, like drilling it into your mind, you know. And I believe in it a little bit. You'll see these high-level UFC fighters come out after not being in the ring for 2 years, and character, that's a whole different level of muscle memory and discipline. You know, these guys have worked their whole life really to be a fighter. and then they take 1 or 2 years off. Yeah. And when these guys take 1 or 2 years off, they're not really taking 1 or 2 years off. They're not taking a break like, say, a normal person like you and I would. That means 1 or 2 years, that means instead of going to the gym, you know, 6 days a week, they're going to the gym 4 days a week. And instead of sparring every day, you know, they're sparring every other day. These guys don't stop. They're obsessed. And so when they say this time off, the only reason why they say it is ring rust, and you notice they don't call it training rust or any of that, they call it ring rust, is because they haven't been in the ring and have the pressure of competition. And the pressure of competition, the pressure of stage lights, the pressure of just pressure. Anybody that doesn't know what pressure is, and you're not living life to the fullest, because pressure really is what makes people shine, you know? Pressure can make people break if you're not used to it, or it can make you shine if you are used to it, because it's empowering, it energizes you if you use it right. Some people, pressure will break them. I've seen fighters, the UFC actually, I'm going to start talking about the UFC more often, because it's really in an exciting place. There's a lot of really cool things going on. They just signed a big deal with ESPN, so they're going to be doing a lot more. A lot more people are going to be seeing it because it's going to be mainstream. They're just coming off of a big deal they had with Fox. Now they're going into ESPN. They're already working on this. I'm annoyed by it, but ESPN Plus, which is an app you sign in and you get like 20 extra fights a year. I thought that's what I got Fight Pass for. But if you don't know what Fight Pass is, it's what I thought was supposed to be what this ESPN Plus is, but it just gives you access to preliminary fights, a really good database of old classic fights for UFC. And if you're a fan, then you really appreciate it. But I don't understand why more people aren't into UFC, because like I've said it before, I look at it like this. You know, when I was in high school, there were some people that would wrestle. You had some people that did karate. And when you heard these people were fighting, you would just run to wherever they were fighting. You get the location. You get the names first, right? Because you got to get the names to see if it's worth being laid to glass. Then you get the location. And then after all said and done, then you find out why they were fighting. But there were some cool fights where, you know, not a kickboxer. It wasn't really common in high school. You'd have more karate, boxing, and wrestling. Those were it, really. And in high school, the wrestlers were just pain in the ass. Like, those guys, they were just rugged, like, I bite your tongue out type crazy. They're freaks, you know. Saratoga guys were, at least. I know that. These guys, I went to track, and the wrestlers ran more than I did. And I was doing track on my events for the 100 to 200 meter dash. And these guys, and 4x1, and these guys were running more than I was. I mean, that's how tough our wrestlers were at Saratoga. So you had someone like that going up against a boxer, like say a DJ Johnson or a Travis Whipple. You know, that was awesome to see. You'd want to show up for that, because Saratoga also had a really good boxing club. So some of our boxers are some of the best in the section. You had wrestlers that are some of the best in the section. You know, and they had kids. Karate wasn't a big deal. So whenever a karate did show up, you wanted to see that, how that was going to go down. So I was always that kid that was racing all the fights to see, you know, okay, what, how is this style going to go up against that style? That's the UFC now on a whole different level. Like, you have people that are training their whole entire lives to fight. They know jiu-jitsu. They know boxing. It's all those disciplines mixed into one. And all of them come in, you know, with a history of collegiate wrestling champ, or, you know, kickboxing champion of the world. And I mean, these guys are all coming in, or jiu-jitsu black belt, third stripe. I mean, these guys are all coming into this, they're all coming into the UFC, and they're all going after the same belt, same weight. It's an amazing thing to see. And now with the ESPN and just the way that the company is being built, there's just a tremendous amount of content being put out, a lot of fights being put out. So I think, especially if you're having some of the names that are popping up on some of these fights, it's just going to get bigger and bigger and bigger, and there's going to be more coverage. It's going to be treated more like football, basketball, and baseball, and it's got the traction now. It has these big names that are drawing an audience. Conor McGregor, he started something with the numbers that he was putting out. He showed that there's way more to this thing. If it's marketed properly, if the athlete has the right attitude, if he has the right appeal, if he talks the right way, if he has the right swagger, it's out there. He made a lot of money. So when he made the amount of money that he made, just himself, individual, and he brought so much attention to the sport, he got other people interested, and they're looking at it now, and they're saying, all right, we got something here. We don't need 10 Conor McGregors, because if you looked at how much he's been in the news lately, you don't want too many of those, because then it's too much. He recently just got arrested in Dublin for some kind of assault charge. When I was in Vegas, I was playing poker with some guys, and they said that he's actually being brought up on rape charges. And the guys that I was talking to were actually from Ireland, and that gives them any credibility, but they were from Ireland. Their accents were ridiculous. But they were saying that there's some local stuff, like TMZ type level, and going on in Dublin, where some really, really popular, like pop girl, is accusing Conor McGregor of rape. No one believes it. It's just really a ploy for money. And then he's just got arrested for some kind of assault thing. So you don't want too many of those people on your roster. But focusing on the positive things they did for the sport, it's got a lot of people looking. It's got a lot of people's attention. So it's just going to get bigger and bigger, and people are going to be seeing it more and more on on the main scene. Granted, you're always going to have the pay-per-view events, but I think like the fight nights and the one-off fights that they like to do, it's just going to be on a bigger screen. And I think finally the athletes that are in the UFC are going to start to get the exposure that they should get, because they are superstars. They are phenomenal athletes. And I think they're doing one of the hardest sports in the world. You know, there's no other sport that you can go into knowing that you could walk out with something broken. You know, like, I'm not saying that those type of injuries don't happen in other sports, because they do. But what I'm saying is that nobody walks into those fields with the intent knowing that this is a possibility of me leaving here. Like, the person across from me is trying to physically inflict pain on me, hurt me, break something on me. And these athletes do that. And when they're training, that's exactly the same that's going on. The people that they're training with them are trying to inflict harm. And their bodies have to get used to recovering. I mean, I'm 38 now, and just waking up sometimes and making sure that everything that was working when I went to sleep was working when I wake up is a battle itself. So for some of these athletes to go to the gym and get pounded on the way that they do, and then wake up and then do it all over again and step into a trained professional, professional killer, that could kill you with their hands. I mean, that's unlike any sport we've ever seen. And it's beginning to take on a whole different form with some of the athletes that are coming out, the names that it's producing, and the associations that are being tied up to it. So if you guys aren't into UFC, it's going to be more mainstream now, and I think you'll have more reason to. Just give it a chance. Take a look at it. And I think when you're a martial artist, you look at UFC completely different. And I think when you watch it with someone that is a martial artist, you look at it completely different, because it's not just about two people getting in there and throwing kicks and trying to hurt each other. It's really about two people in there that are trying to express themselves, and they're doing it by using their limbs. You know, they're using their elbows, their fists, their feet, their knees, their head, and they're using it to defend themselves, and they're using it to push themselves towards a limit, towards their fears, towards limits that were limits prior to, and they're all going for the same thing. I mean, people think it's just going in there and there's blood and they're just beating each other up. It's like, no, it's terrifying to walk into a ring and it close, and they say go, and when it's all said and done, one person's gonna have their hand raised. If you think about that scenario, there's a lot of self-perseverance in that opportunity there, in that situation there. A lot of people that fight on a high level say you're not fighting against anybody else except for yourself when you're in there against somebody else. And it's true. And, you know, that person's doing the same thing that me and you are doing throughout the day. we're all fighting to get to that next level. We're all fighting to conquer ourselves. We're all fighting to conquer our fears. You know, most of us should be, even if we aren't. That's the goal. And I think that a lot of fighters that step into that, they're doing that at a much higher level. Just like comedians when they step on stage and they're telling their jokes, everyone's laughing. You know, even when you're watching the fights, everyone's applauding, and they're screaming and they're shouting and they're cheering. But the person on stage, he's having a completely different experience than everybody that's, you know, watching it. You know, for me, when I'm on stage, it's all those excuses that could have happened throughout the week, that could have happened in that month while I was preparing for that act. You know, the distractions you have with your family, the distractions you have with work, your career, your job. It's not a distraction to you because it's very important. But at the time when you're trying to do something else that you love, that you're passionate about, that you care about, that means something to you, it is a distraction. And if you have deadlines and you have, you know, networking events you have to go to, all of those things, they could possibly get in the way of your dream. But when I make it on stage, that means that they didn't. That means that I was focused enough, that I was tuned in, and I was dedicated enough to make sure that everything that I needed to do to make sure that when I was on that stage, I'm 100% present within that moment, I'm 100% prepared, I'm 100% confident in my ability because I put the work in, I didn't let the distractions get in my way, and I'm just expressing stuff that, you know, some of the times it's funny. Just the whole entire premise of it's funny. Sometimes I'm being an alchemist and I'm taking something as painful and as draining and as, you know, destructive as a divorce and making it funny. Sometimes it's just, like I said, it's just funny stuff that I just made an observation of. And from the time that I made that observation, it could have been 6 months prior to, you know, 3 weeks prior to, whenever. And I took that observation, I put it into my phone, right? Got it on paper, like I said. Went home, sat down in front of my computer and tried to mold it into something that I felt was, you know, relatable, that I felt was worthy of noting my perspective on. And from the time I bring it to on stage at my first open mic to the time I get the laugh that I thought I was going to get to the laugh that I didn't think I was going to get, the time I go back and craft it more and more and fine-tune it, then bring it back to that open mic. And then the hours, the endless hours that I put into perfecting that joke, repeating it and just finding the different crevices and the different points of that joke. And then finally being able to put it on stage, bring it all together, put it in the right act with the other order, do it in the right order and the right act with the other jokes that I was working on and present it to the people that are in front of me. And just nail it to the point that they're laughing as hard as I thought the joke was. They're laughing as hard as I was the first time I thought of the joke. Granted, right? It's not going to be the same joke from when I first made the observation. But it's after I crafted it, after I got the feedback, and after I implemented the changes made from the feedback. Now we're on to something. And when I'm on that stage, all of that time and all of that preparation and all of that expression, all that release, it's all happening. And that's what I'm experiencing. Everyone else is just experiencing the jokes, but I'm experiencing all that. Plus, I'm in the moment. It's just an amazing thing. And that's why I like to share that with other people. And it's the same thing with those fighters. You know, when they're in that ring and they're thinking about all the injuries that they went through, and they're not thinking about it within the moment. That's not, well, when I said that, I might have said that wrong. I mean, it's not all within the moment. It's while you're on that stage. It's leading right up before you get on that stage and after the right after that act, the actual performance. All those things rush through you. It's the same thing with that person that's inside that ring. It's a whole different experience. Everything that brought them to me, to that moment, to being in front of those thousands and thousands of people inside that ring that's locked. All that training, your three-month training camp, the injuries that you battled, the distractions, you know, with your wife calling you or your husband calling you or your boyfriend or, you know, bills that need to be paid, unexpected expenses popping up, you getting sick. That date is still coming. You still have to show up. You still have to perform. And if you don't, for a fighter, then it risks you getting injured. It risks you possibly never fighting again. not because of the injury, just because you suck that much and no one wants to see you fight again. Or in some cases, it could result in you losing a title or a belt. For a comedian, you're not really losing anything except for your pride or the fear of, you know, failure, to where no one's laughing at your joke because you're not prepared, because you were distracted, because instead of focusing on your act, you were focusing on some letter that you got, or you're focusing on some phone call that you had with your ex, and you're just not there. All of those, being able to conquer all those things and still do what you say you're going to do and still execute on a high level, it's not easy. And the more you do it, the more you respect others that do it, the more you become accustomed to it, the more you, you know, respect the process. You know, respect the process is a very, very important thing. And some people just don't have the right process. And when I first started comedy, I was blessed with, when I first started doing jiu-jitsu, I was exposed to people that had the right process. And I just followed the process without any question until I had enough experience that I'd seen it work so I could make my own slight modifications. But nothing that's going to really alter the process, just, you know, heighten things that I tend to like. So I'll give you an example with writing. Bill Keller used to say, you know, always write at least an hour a day. I can't write an hour a day consecutively. So what I'll do is I'll just break it up 15 minutes in the morning. Then, you know, in the day, middle of the day, I'll write. And then at the end, I'll give it a half an hour run. That's as far as I've modified it. But I'm still getting my writing in. It's still an hour. And when I'm writing for comedy, it has to happen every day. Because anybody that's writing knows sometimes you could write for 2 minutes and you have a brilliant idea. Sometimes you could write for 3 days and just get one brilliant idea. And that's just a fact of it. That's just the way it works. So with comedy, to get a good joke, sometimes that's what it takes. You got to pump out 100 good jokes before you get a real funny joke, you know? That piece of, when I was going into the graduation show, I had so many jokes written down. I think it was 45. No, there was more than that. It was like 80 jokes. It was insane. And then we whittled it down to, you know, 45. And it was insane, but it was awesome writing all those jokes. And it was awesome turning them into something. That was fun. It was a nice rush. And it was a nice, like, practice. I have to do that again. Sorry about that. Just bumped the mic. But, yeah. So confidence. What else can I say about confidence? George St. Pierre, he's actually a legend in the UFC world. And he was talking about, you know, faking it till you make it. And I hear a lot of people say it, and there's so many different ways to look at that saying, right? And I think the way that I look at it isn't the best way, but it's a pretty cool way. You know, fake it till you make it doesn't mean you won't running around looking like a clown, pretending to be something that you're not, you know? Fake it till you make it means that's you're doing, you're aspiring to become something. And you're doing everything you can as if you're already there. So that when you get there, you know what it's like, you know? It also tells the universe something too. It tells the universe you're serious and you know what you want. And you'll know when you get there what it looks like. The universe needs that. And that's why people say, right, put it on paper so it's exact, it's precise, it's specific. But yeah, I mean, making sure that you are 100% committed to, all right, this is how I'm going to dress, even though I'm not making that, you know, six figures, this is how I'm going to dress when I make six figures. Don't get lost in the fact you're running around dressed like someone making six figures. Do all the behaviors that occupy someone that's doing six figures, not just the dressing. George St. Pierre put it the best way. He was saying, you know, when I'm faking it is when I'm scared. It's right before I go out to a fight. He was actually very famously quoted saying that he's terrified walking down to the gym, walking down to the ring. And people, when you see George St. Pierre fight, you'll be like, how is this guy scared? But he's saying when he's walking down to the ring, he's terrified, but he's not showing that. He looks like he's fired up, he's pumped, he's ready to go, extremely confident. And he's not. And when he steps into the ring and he makes his circle running around, he's still not confident. He's still not fired up. He's just showing that he's exuding it. He's faking it until he makes it. It's not until the bell rings. Well, yeah, the cage closes, it locks, and the bells ring. And, you know, and after they touch mitts, that's when he's there. That's when he's 100% ready to go. That's when he's not faking it. That's when the real him is there. But all of those things that he's fighting up until that point are just nerves. And he recognizes that, but he doesn't submit to those nerves. Instead, he kind of overpumps himself up to get through that. And sometimes you have to do that. When you're in a big moment right before something, I remember before races, my nerves used to rush through me. I wouldn't be able to calm myself down. My legs would shake and I would just be pacing back and forth like a tiger in a cage. And I realized that I do the same thing before my comedy acts. I pace back and forth like a caged animal. I used to do the same thing when I was in track. And it's not necessarily nerves. It's what I do before I do something. You know? And someone looking at me would think that I'm nervous. And it's not nerves. It's just me. It's my part of my ritual. And it's important for people to have rituals before they do something, before, you know, they go on stage, before they run an event, before they say a speech. There's a lot of people, when they do things over and over like that, they have rituals. And those rituals are just ways to just kind of relax you, you know. They just kind of set you into this rhythm that you're focused more on that rhythm than you are the situation, you know. If you're focused on, you know, if you're pacing back and forth, you're not focused on the pressure. You know, if you're pacing back and forth, you're not looking up at your competitors to see what they're trying to do to get into your head. In fact, a lot of them are going to be watching you like, why the hell is this guy pacing back and forth? And that's how it happened in track a lot. That's how I know that. So, you know, the hardest thing is not being prepared. And if you don't have the pressure of open mics, and if you don't have the pressure of hearing what it feels like to have your name called up on the microphone for you to go up on stage, the first time you hear it, it's going to be crazy. Like, well, what's the best way to put this? So if I had never gone up on stage, if I had never done an open mic before doing my graduation show, the first one, how would I feel? You know, I don't know. I know that doing the open mics made me so much more prepared, like 300 times more prepared, because the pressure of people, a stage is a stage. And when there's people out there watching you, if it's more than five people, it doesn't matter. It's five strangers. It doesn't matter. The laughter is different, but the pressure is the same. And then whenever you start adding more people to that number, the pressure just piles up more and more. And it's nothing to be fearful of. It's only fearful if you're not prepared for it. It's awesome if you're prepared for it. To have that many people laughing in cadence in something that you said is amazing. It's a rush. You know, 20 people is a lot different than 5 people, which is a lot different than 50, which is a lot different than 100. It just gets bigger and bigger. And it's one thing when I look at, like, Kevin Hart and I see the shows that he's doing, and I see, you know, Cat Williams and the shows that they're doing. They're just massive audiences. And I can't even imagine what it's like, the energy that these guys get, the rush that they get from being in front of an audience like that, and the charge they get from those laughs. It just really has to, first of all, I know it energizes them to the point that it carries them through the show. That's a fact. Not that any of them need to be carried, because if you look at some of these comics, a lot of them are in really, really good shape physically because of how physical they are on stage and how much they're moving on stage. So they're more than physically and mentally capable of, you know, doing these shows. But the energy that it just charges you when you're up there, when people are laughing, and some of these laughs that these guys get, it's just absolutely amazing. And it's just years and years and years of just crafting their jokes, crafting their act, tailoring their act, making it sharper, making it better. Just their use of technique, their application of technique. It's just, when you're from the outside looking and you know what they're doing, a lot of them just leave you in awe with what they're doing. And I hope to get to that level. I know how much work they're putting into it. I know that they have teams of people that are working with them for on all aspects of comedy, from writing to helping them with the performance. And I mean, it's just a, it's a production there. You know, lives are depending on you showing up to work and being funny. So lives are going to be dedicated to making sure that when you show up to work, you're funny. And I'm not taking away anything from those comics, but that's just a level that they're on. That's a completely different level from someone like me that's just getting started, that's learning how to write jokes and learning how to be funny and trying to find himself on stage. I have a lot of respect for those guys. So, yeah. So what else do we have about confidence? Fake confidence is funny. Fake confidence is like, to women, it's like skunk perfume. They can smell it from a mile away. That's one thing that I've learned about confidence, is that, you know, you can fool a lot of people. Guys can fool guys easily, but guys, you cannot fool women with fake confidence. Women have this way that they can smell if you're broke. It doesn't matter how well you're dressed, how good your swag is. If you have an unpaid bill, they can pick it up. and they do that very well. And they, the only thing they do better than that is confidence. They pick it up when it's fake, when it's not real. Some of them will buy into it just to humor you, but they know. It's like a seventh sense that they have. Maybe actually it should be like an eighth sense that they have, because they just pick it up. And it's just subtle things that tell you if someone is confident or not. And women are just so much more in tune with it. And I think it's because their decision, based on how confident you are and whether you're bullshitting or not, is critical to them, right? If you think if you're acting like you're the man, and you're driving this, and you got this, and you have this credit card and your thing, and them deciding to say, okay, this is going to be my partner. If they're wrong, then they just screwed themselves and they just made a bad investment. Women really don't make bad investments in themselves. They'll make bad investments with money, but not when it comes to themselves. And finding out, sniffing out a sucker is what they're really, really good at. And I mean, a sucker in the chump is like the chump that's trying to be something that he's not. You know, but it's true. It's those subtle tells. And a part of mixed martial arts that happens is the stare down. You know, if you go back and you look and see some of the videos of Mike Tyson staring down his competition before fights, it's amazing to see him. He's basically looking through these people. It's like he's like looking through their soul, and he's just searching for that weakness. And a lot of times he'll say, I beat these people before the fight because of something he saw and during the stare down, or something he saw when they were looking at each other, you know, during the conference or something. And it's because you just saw that their confidence really wasn't there. It was a facade to kind of throw you off of their real fears. And once you break that, man, you just have people in your hand. And women, with all jokes aside, they can tell that by how you carry yourself, you know, the truck that you drive, if you're overcompensating for something. They're really, really good at that. And they're also very in tune with situations that are uncomfortable. And word doesn't need to be said. Eye contact doesn't need to be made. They just have this sense to them where they know, you know, something is off. Like I've been reading on Facebook, there's been some instances where women are posting that there's creepy guys in Lowe's and Walmart. Walmart doesn't surprise me. Lowe's kind of does. But just these guys are just follow them at the end of the aisles. And, you know, walking around as a man, you don't really think about that. You know, you don't really think there's going to be a creep in a public area like Lowe's running around creeping ladies out, you know? And when I say that as a man, I'm not saying it another way than I should be more aware and more in tune to those situations. I think after... And it's good that women post those things, and men should post those things too if they see those situations going down, to make people aware of where they're going down and what this person looks like, to put people on high alert and to put people that are in a position to protect, you know? I mean, I'm not saying let's put hits out on people via Facebook, but I'm just saying for people to be more in tune, so if a situation is going down, maybe there's, you know, maybe there's a miscommunication there. And maybe that person has a fear that doesn't need to be there, or someone's being feared that they don't need to be feared. You know, there are a lot of creepy things, a lot of creepy guys out there. Don't get me wrong, but there's a lot of women that like to say creeps are creepy just for this just because I like using that word creepy, you know. But at the end of the day, if someone feels that they're not safe, or they feel that they're in a situation, especially in a public place where there's other people around, then, you know, it's good that you guys are placing it on Facebook. It just surprises me how common and how often these uncomfortable situations happen, you know. The Lowe's people are following people in the appliance and not talking, just staring at them and following them out to their car. I mean, even if you know self-defense, that's a situation you just don't want to engage. That's a situation where you have to get someone else involved, male or female, you know. It's sad that there's such sick people running around this world doing stuff like that. And that's what I'm saying, you know, that's why there's that need for that self-defense, just knowing how to protect yourself. So when you're in those type of situations and you exude that confidence, so when you say something, that person reacts and they know, okay, this person means business. This is not going to be an easy target, you know? And sometimes that's what they're looking for, just an easy target, someone to intimidate, someone to scare or control, just by putting that sense of fear in them. So that's pretty much what I have for confidence. Hopefully I covered that pretty well. But I mean, yeah, just to wrap it up, yeah, confidence comes from experience, man. And the more times you put yourself into a certain situation, you become familiar with that outcome, knowing yourself, knowing, you know, taking into account past experience and how you reacted in those past situations and what the outcomes of those past situations were. The more that you end up in a positive light, the more confident you are going into the situation that it's going to work out the way that it should. And, you know, for all those people that are thinking about, you know, getting into comedy or getting into anything, chasing your passion, the first thing is actually, you know, getting it on paper, writing it down. That's the first. And why is that so important? I'm going to go back to that, because I always say it and people, they laugh or they walk off and then they say they're going to do it and then they don't. And I remember when I first got that concept down, you know, putting it on paper, and the person said to me, look, I'm going to tell you what you need to do to be successful. If you don't do it, you won't be successful. But if you do, be successful. Simple. And he said the first thing was get it down on paper. And he said this. It's very simple. If you can't get it down on paper, if you don't have the time, if you don't have the dedication, if you don't have the commitment to write it down on paper, then what's the likelihood that you're actually going to get it done? Because that's the simplest step. That's the easiest part of it. If you can't do that, then how are you going to get the rest of it done if that's the easiest part? And that's always kind of stuck to me. And that's whenever I'm doing something and it's a project and it requires being serious and it requires some dedication, the first thing I do is I write it down. And what am I writing down? I write down what I'm trying to do, what is the desired outcome of what I'm trying to do, and I put a date towards it. I don't just put that somewhere after I write it down. I don't just push it off to my side of my desk. I put it somewhere where I can see it and be reminded of it and build a plan around it. And whenever I do something like that, whenever I write it down, whenever I decide what the desired outcomes are, and I start to execute, it always happens. It always works out the way it should. And the level of execution, because I've written it down, is usually a little bit better than something that I just say I'm going to do and go through and get it done. Why? I don't know. Actually, I do know, because I have an outline and I have a focus. And I know what I'm looking for. I know what I'm doing, you know. If you can't write down what your goals are, then you probably don't know what they are. So, and that's just the true thing. You know, when you write down, you know, this many shows and you're going to be doing graduation and this is the day of the class, and it's amazing. It's amazing what the results are. So just try that. And I like when this isn't even a challenge. It's kind of a gem. It's like a hidden gem. And I hope someone out there listening tries it and just gives me the feedback. Just do it on little things and build up. You know, start off with a to-do list, things that you know you got to get done, just write them down, and then get used to the pleasure of crossing those things off that list, and then get fancy with it. Then write down a goal that's going to take a little bit of time and a little bit of work, and put a date out there that's like, you know, a month away, and start working towards it and see mentally in your head, have a list of things that you just want to do and then have a list of things that you want to do and write them down and see which ones actually get done. And you'll be surprised at the ones that you write down. And it's the ones that you can see and be reminded of. This is a gem. And if you apply it, you know, you'd be really surprised at the results of it. And this is just for people that, like I said, that are trying to think about doing something new and they're kind of struggling to get it off the road or they're stuck. And anything that's worth doing is long and arduous, you know? It's not going to be easy and quick. It's going to be a process and it's going to take time. Same thing with this podcast that I'm doing. I have this goal of 25 podcasts, which I'm quickly approaching. 9 more and I'll hit my goal. You know, when I first started, I had 25. Now I'm going to have 9 more. Actually, I had some technical difficulties on 2 of the episodes. So if I'm being honest with myself, I really owe more like 11 episodes. But, and I'm going to be honest with myself. So guess what? Yep, you heard it first. 11 episodes until I hit my goal. And that's not something that is bad that I have to do 2 more episodes. It's just something that I'm holding myself accountable for. And that's what you have to do. You have to be that honest with yourself when you're trying to get results and be the best and be great and be awesome. And, you know, I think that's another part of it that people struggle with is the honesty. You know, when they're coming up with these excuses as to why they aren't doing something or these excuses get in your way, what are you doing? Are you being honest with yourself? Is that excuse really big enough to prevent you from your dream? Is that just the universe testing you to see how much you really want your dream? You know, that's the way that I look at it. You know, is this car not starting going to prevent me from getting to that open mic? You know, because that's happened to me. Is this flat tire going to prevent me from getting to this open mic? Because that's happened to me, you know? Is this tenant calling you because they're locked out of the house and you have to be, you know, at class in 2 hours and all this is going to take you 3? How are you going to figure this out? Is that going to be a big enough distraction to prevent you from going to class? The class that's going to get ready, prepare you for that show that you have on the 7th. I mean, all of these things, they happen, and how you navigate them is really going to determine how successful you're going to be. It's the same thing with the poker players that are top-level poker players that are making a living. And when I say making a living, I'm not talking about $50,000 a year. These people are millionaires playing cards. And it's because they get their time in when they're playing just off-season. Well, they don't really have an off-season, but when they're just playing, you know, cash games, they're not in tournaments running these big, winning these big cash prizes. But they're showing up and they're putting their time in and they're getting their rakes in. Rakes is the amount of hands that you're playing in. If they're playing a lot of hands so that their instincts there, the calculations there, they, you know, they can read tells very well. They're doing all that, but they're putting in their time. And they are navigating those bad hands just better than, you know, the average person, because the average person is getting dealt those same bad hands. But they're just not reacting to them the same, and they're just not playing them the same. And what pros do, they get a bad hand, they play it like it's a great one, you know? There's pros out there that'll get the worst hand possible in poker, which is 2-7. And they'll play it like it's pocket aces, betting into you like they got pocket aces. And that's really what you have to do when you have a goal and you're focused on that goal, is you get dealt a shitty hand, or you get dealt a shitty situation, you play it out like it's the best situation you've ever had, you know? And you go at it with that attitude. And one, it fucking throws off the universe, for one. And two, it kind of builds a resistance in yourself that it makes you impenetrable in terms of your psyche and your mental fortitude. Because negativity is what erodes you, you know? Negativity and being around negative people that don't really want the best for you, that don't really want the best for themselves. And we all know who those people are, you know? And the closer they are and the more time they spend with you is the more, you know, eroded and the more negative and the more tainted your perception is on life. And they just kind of drain you. So it's really important to be around those positive people and keep that negativity out of your mind and just train yourself to, when you get put in those negative situations, that, you know, this really isn't that bad. This is an opportunity for me to learn, or this is an opportunity for me to get better, or this is an opportunity for me to figure it out. And sometimes we get too emotional, and that's what clouds you from making the right decision. I know that I've done that a few times, just letting emotion override what's really at hand, and it kind of camouflages what you're really trying to deal with, so nothing really gets dealt with. So just keeping yourself in check with how you manage your emotions is huge. And that comes back again to just being positive. Whenever something negative gets thrown at you, just navigating it with the most positive mindset that you can possibly, you know, that you possibly have. And one thing, it's another thing that I was saying before, you know, when you're doing something like martial arts, jiu-jitsu, or boxing, or working out every day, just something that kind of lets you meditate in its own way. I said it earlier, you know, jiu-jitsu is a different form of meditation than weightlifting, and it's a different form of meditation than jogging, and a different form of meditation than yoga, than Pilates, but it's all meditation, and it all allows you to be healthy. And the more that you're doing those type of healthy things, putting healthy things into your body, like your diet. When I'm doing jiu-jitsu, I have to have a good diet. And when I have a good diet, then mentally I'm healthier. Mentally I'm stronger. When I'm drinking my water throughout the day, because I know I'm going to roll for 2 hours. And I know that if I don't drink my water, then I'm going to cramp up. And I know that I don't want to cramp up, because that just sucks for so many different reasons. You lose cool points. And it just sucks in the middle of a roll having to stop because you cramp. It makes you, I don't know about anybody else, but cramping up makes me feel old. It makes me feel like just old, like raggedy. You know, when your body cramps up, what is really going on there? Is it dehydration? Is that really what it is? Because it doesn't feel like it. It feels like I'm pushing my body to a limit that it shouldn't be. It's like my body is rejecting what I'm asking it to do. That's what a cramp is. A cramp is like your body being a 2-year-old yelling no to you. you know what I mean? Like every single time that I've cramped up, it just feels like my body is screaming at me, no, we're not going. And you have to listen to it. You know, like I've never cramped up and looked cool in the middle of it. I've tried to play it off, but then I look like an ass. And I feel like one. But so that's what I'm saying. You know, when you make good decisions, good things happen, because a good decision is to do jiu-jitsu. In doing jiu-jitsu, I have to eat healthier. In being healthier, mentally I'm stronger. Taking in my increased water intake on a daily basis is just good. There's just so many different good things that go with it, but it all stems from something like jiu-jitsu. So I hope you guys, you know, all have, and if you don't, you should start working towards having something in your life that's a positive like that, that brings positive people into your life, that gives you a positive outlook, that forces you to push yourself every day. You know, there's no off day in jiu-jitsu. When you're on that mat, man, listen, if you showed up sluggish, there's at least 3 other people that didn't. And if you're going to roll with them, you're not going to be rolling with them sluggish. It's just not going to happen. You're going to have to step it up. So just being in that environment alone allows you to step it up. So, and same thing with the comedian. You know, if you go to an open mic and you didn't work that week, you didn't write, you didn't show up, guess what? It's going to show. It's going to show in your performance. It's going to show on the laughs you get. And that's when the honesty part kicks in. You know, are you sucking because you're not a good comic? Or are you sucking because you didn't show up? Are you sucking because you're not good at this? Or are you sucking because you didn't put enough effort in? I mean, effort's the deciding factor in everything. So, that's pretty much it for what we're talking about this episode. Kind of went on a rant there, but that's what I do on the podcast. You go on these big, long rants. But, I'm going to leave you guys with that. This week's going to be a busy week for me. I'm really excited. There's a lot of cool things going on. I'm going to be checking out a comedy, some comedy in Vermont this week. Just trying to get inspired for the next show. I keep on looking up the dates for the Clash of the Comics for February. I don't say anything for February or March, but they'll get it up. And once they do, I'll let you guys know right away. As I mentioned last week, I am going to be trying to be doing one episode every week. There will be guests coming in. I do have a nice roster of less of guests. less that I'm excited about. And this year is going to be a really exciting year. We're off to a good start. This snow, oh, people in the Northeast, a lot of you guys are snowed in. Probably when you're listening to this, you'll probably be driving and looking around and taking in all the snow, all 19 inches of it. If you're up in Albany, in the Albany, upstate New York area, we really got dumped on. So it was interesting. Interesting weather. But it's wintertime, so what do you expect? And it's our first storm, and I don't think it'll be our last. But yeah, so I'm going to wrap this one up. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the week. All right, bye.